So now we are going to look at right-way Jonah. 2 weeks ago, we looked at wrong-way Jonah, when he was supposed to go east, and he went west. But God has a way of straightening these things out. Next slide. This is a famous mosaic of Alexander the Great on his favorite horse. And the horse's name is Bucephalus. And Bucephalus means ox head. It communicates more to our English idiom to say bullheaded. This particular horse, everyone, all the king's men, were trying to break this horse, and they could not. And Alexander was watching, and he was young. He was a young man, and he was watching everybody, all these highly skilled horse trainers absolutely failed in training this horse. They couldn't break it. And Alexander told his father, Philip, I can ride it. His father said, if they can't ride it, you can't ride it either. He said, I can ride it. And he said, if I can't, I'll buy the horse, I'll pay for it with my own money. So finally his father said, okay, give it a try. And to everyone's amazement, Alexander got on the horse and rode it. And he was on the horse for hours, sort of like getting on your motorcycle and going 700 plus miles in a day. But the interesting thing is, Alexander rode toward the sun. And it wasn't until he had gained control of Bucephalus that he turned around, because what he noticed was that as soon as a rider got on, Bucephalus looked down, saw the shadow of the man who was riding his back, and panicked. And so Alexander rode the horse toward the sun, and the horse accepted him, and by the time he turned around, Bucephalus was his. You know, Alexander did some truly amazing things. I believe that God enabled him to accomplish some very interesting things. The book of Daniel actually predicts Alexander the Great. And when Alexander was conquering and he came towards Jerusalem, the chief priests went out, according to legend, and I think it probably is a credible story. They went out and they told him, you know, our holy book tells about you. And as a result, Alexander treated the Jews very well. They ended up in high positions in his government and all sorts of things. I'd like for us to look at the passage that covers that. After it discusses a ram that is representing Media Persia, said there was no power in the ram, that is Media Persia, to withstand him, Alexander. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I started reading the wrong slide. Suddenly a male goat, Alexander, came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. Speaking about how he just went across and conquered vast areas of countryside quickly, having a great extent of his empire. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. I think that that's a reference to Alexander. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, Media Persia. You'd have to look earlier in the passage to see how that is picturing Media Persia, which had been standing beside the river and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, and he cast the ram down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he had become strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. When Alexander died prematurely in India, he was replaced by his four generals. Well, then the passage goes on to describe Antiochus Epiphanes, who cursed Israel. And God ultimately had to take the kingdom away from Greece, take it away from Antiochus Epiphanes. But what we see is God enabled Alexander to conquer great territory. He went from a little province, a little place up in northern Greece, the kingdom of Macedon, and he went on to conquer all of the known world, and then he suddenly died. No more worlds to conquer, and his four generals split up his kingdom, and ultimately, Greece came to curse Israel. God has announced his foreign policy in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. Genesis 12, 3 says, I will bless those that bless you, Israel, and I will curse him who curses you. And human history is littered with all the nations that have fallen after they have turned against Israel. As we are looking in the book of Jonah, we are looking long before Alexander came to power. We're looking over 300 years before Alexander came to power. And the great world power of that day is Assyria. And the de facto capital, not the actual capital, but the de facto capital of Assyria at the time that Jonah was alive was Nineveh. God sent Jonah in order to make proclamation against Nineveh, against the Assyrian Empire. And there is evidence, and we're going to see some of the evidence today, that shows that Assyria was planning an attack against Israel, against the northern kingdom. But it is premature. It's before the time that iniquity was ripe in the northern kingdom. It's before God wanted Assyria to do this. At a later point in history, in the year 722, God did allow Assyria to overwhelm the northern kingdom, Israel. Let me tell you how Assyria raised revenue. They had an interesting policy. They didn't have an IRS. They had a different way of going about collecting their revenues. They would subjugate a country and make them pay tribute. And the next year, they would go subjugate another country and make them pay tribute. And if anyone stopped paying their annual tribute, then they'd go back and visit that country again. And so at the time of Jonah, things got really bad for Assyria. They really got bad. It became so bad that they were not able to mount one of their tribute collecting raids. They had none for the year at all. And I believe that the place that they had planned to hit was the northern kingdom, Israel. And it's going to turn out that Jonah later on is going to figure out, hey, it's absolutely wonderful that God didn't have to destroy Nineveh or Assyria for coming and attacking Israel when they weren't supposed to. The blessing was Israel's still intact, and God doesn't have to punish Assyria. Okay, let's now start at the beginning in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. God again commanded Jonah to go to Nineveh to preach judgment against it. Verses 1 and 2. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you. Notice that in God's opinion, this is a great city. God is the speaker, and God calls Nineveh a great city. That's going to have implications later. God regards it as a great city. Notice it says that he has given this message to Jonah the second time, because if we go back to Jonah chapter 1, verse 2, he told him the first time, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." So Jonah, this time, obeys. Last time, he tried to go to Tarshish, and the Lord managed to bring him back around to going eastward in obedience to him. Well, in verse 3, we are told, next slide, that Jonah arose and went to Nineveh, according to the word of the Lord. Now, Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey in extent. Please notice, if you're looking at a version like the New King James, it says in extent at the end, but it's in italics. It's not part of the Hebrew text. He says it's a three-day journey, but he doesn't describe what he means by three-day journey. Now, as you look at the map, there are a couple of ovals. The one that's northward is Nineveh, and the one in the south is Baghdad. So you get some sort of an idea of the relationship of Baghdad to Nineveh. But the question becomes, what does it mean it is a three-day journey? Well, since Jonah had to travel 600 miles and he didn't have a Yank tank, that is, a Dodge diesel dually like I have, nor did he have a Learjet, it's going to take him a little while. He's walking. Besides that, he looks like death warmed over because he was inside the belly of that fish for a period of time, and all those stomach juices were working on his skin. People who have had similar experiences cannot handle the sunlight. That's going to have an important effect later on in the book when Jonah likes to have shade. He doesn't like to be out there in the sun in Nineveh. And as you remember from Desert Storm and Desert Shield and from all the operations, it gets a little hot there in the summer. So it's not talking about the 600-mile journey. That would take a lot longer than 3 days. It turns out instead that 3 days is describing the greatness of the city. Now, some people have thought that it meant that the city was so huge that it would take 3 days to go around the outside of the city. It's that big a city. But that doesn't work out. Let's take a look at some more slides. That little circle there is showing some of the mounds and some of the buildings that have been restored at Nineveh. And these things that look like hills are not hills. In this part of Iraq, they do not have a lot of stone. So when they built things, they would build them out of mud bricks. And after a while, the mud bricks kind of disintegrate and so on and so forth. And what look like hills are old buildings that have just fallen into decay. Well, let's take another look at the wall ruins. And we have a larger circle showing the general area, but then we have the immediate vicinity of these walls. It's only 6.7 miles around. 6.7 miles to go around the city walls does not take 3 days. Well, let's take another look at some of these mounds. Next slide. And actually, what we have is evidence that these are disintegrated buildings, as we look at this particular picture. Now, Saddam Hussein wanted to show himself to be a great conqueror, so he restored some of the buildings. And so here we have some of the buildings that have been put up in modern times meant to look like the old buildings. However, next slide, if you look there, you'll see a concrete framework. It just looks like the old buildings. They weren't built the same way as the old buildings. But then there's a very interesting place, next slide, and the name of this place is fascinating, Nevi Yunus. Now, Nevi is the word prophet, and Eunice is their way of saying Jonah. They called this part of the city on the southwestern edge the prophet Jonah. Now, why would they name a place in Nineveh the prophet Jonah if it didn't really happen? I mean, isn't it really a wonderful story that all these people would love to proclaim? Oh, yes, someone came telling us about the God of Israel, and wow, you know, we became really thrilled about that, and so we decided that we'd dedicate this place. Would this place be named that if they didn't think that Jonah had really been there to visit? This has a certain ring of truth, doesn't it? Let's look at a perimeter of the city. These are the city walls, and it's only 7.3 miles to get around it. So scholars have recognized that a three-day journey is not talking about how long it takes to get around it. Well, some people propose, well, maybe it was just like Los Angeles. You know, suburbs and suburbs and suburbs and more suburbs. I mean, I remember we would want to get out of Southern California, and we could be driving for an hour and a half if the traffic was flowing, and we'd still be in city. You know, you couldn't just drive outside of the city. That's one of the things we like about Denver. It's easy to get out, especially when you live in Bennett. It's really easy to get out of town. Some people have thought that it was saying there are so many suburbs around this that it took 3 days for him to walk through what is part of the city. But that doesn't work either. Look at verse 4. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. He's actually in the city proper, and he's making proclamation, and I'm going to argue that the proclamation is made to a lower-level official. I mean, he goes to a guard shack, and he says, basically, God is planning to destroy Nineveh in 40 days. This is on his first day. Now the question becomes, what does it mean, a three-day journey? Notice in your notes, I have put a quote from the Word Biblical Commentary on Douglas Stewart's commentary on the book of Jonah. Nineveh was a three-day visit city, a major diplomatic center of the ancient world, a city where formal protocol was observed by official visitors whose business could not be accomplished hastily. In other words, you would have one day where you went and announced your business to some official who would then carry it on through official channels, and finally the king would decide whether it was worthy of his time to see you. There would be opening ceremonies, they'd have all sorts of special things, and then eventually you conduct business with the king. This is a way. This type of wording is used for saying, Jonah, you're supposed to go in there, you go through the official protocols, and you finally get an audience with the king. Take your time, do this the right way. This is something that needs to be handled properly. But immediately, things didn't go according to plan. It immediately changed. And this next slide might give an idea of how I see things going. Basically, what I think happened is Jonah told this lower-level official 40 days from now and Nineveh is going to be destroyed, and the message went through the grapevine like wildfire. Because the people at this particular year were ripe for this message, especially looking at someone who looks like death warmed over. Someone who has been exposed to stomach juices of a fish and who actually died and was resurrected, as we pointed out last week. And so Jonah's message is believed. And as a result, yes, it goes through the upper channels, but the guy gets on his cell phone and says, "Hey, I just had someone here announce God is going to destroy this city." And the message just spreads like wildfire. Why would the message of some lone Jewish prophet have such an impact in Nineveh? Glad you asked. On June the 15th, 763 BC, Assyrian records mention that there was a solar eclipse. And lo and behold, astronomers are able to date it. In other words, the Assyrians tell us the name of the year, and we have been able to date it down to exactly when it happened. Now, as you look at this slide, you'll notice on the left-hand side, that's what the sun looks like from the Earth in a solar eclipse in an area that has been hit by the eclipse. You look, and there's still light, but there's clearly darkness because of the moon coming between the sun and the Earth. But now as you look at the right-hand side, up at the top is the sun, and it's showing the angle of its light, and then you have the Earth at the bottom, and the moon is there in between them, and there is a point on the Earth where darkness has hit the Earth. Now we're going to see, what does it look like from space? This dark spot here is one that is dead center in the middle of a solar eclipse. And this picture was taken on August 11th, 1999, from the Mir space station. Interestingly enough, in Assyrian records, when they mention this eclipse, there are all sorts of statements. The king will be deposed. It's like, God is telling us we are coming under judgment. The gods are warning us. And lo and behold, here comes a guy traipsing into town looking like death warmed over. And he says, 40 days from now, God is going to destroy Nineveh. And they've had this happen. They have thought that the king was going to be deposed. They didn't end up waging a campaign to extort money from Israel. These people are beside themselves. And on top of that, next slide, there was a huge earthquake. And here we see a toppled statue at Nevi Yunus. And you remember Nevi Yunus is Prophet Jonah, and that's in the city of Nineveh. They had a huge earthquake, so they're saying, oh, things are getting really bad. On top of that, they have a threat from a northern kingdom, the kingdom of Urartu, that area that's the tawny, orangey, yellowish color, is the kingdom of Urartu, and then the green is the area of Assyria, with the circle and the arrow being the area of Nineveh. And they have been having problems from their northern neighbors. Basically, what is happening is this is a city that is saying everything is falling apart. Kind of looks like the United States in the year 2012, doesn't it? They're saying, what do we do? How are we going to deliver ourselves? They're ready for someone to tell them about a horrendous thing happening. And furthermore, during the 7 years leading up to this, there had been famines and plagues in the area surrounding Nineveh. And interestingly enough, the year after all of these events happened, King Ashurden moved out of Nineveh and he went to another place to be his de facto capital. Nineveh he regarded as a cursed location, and we have the documentation that he moved out of there. Basically, people were petrified, and Jonah has this message. I think Jonah figured, I walk into town and all these Assyrians, this great military power, they're going to look at me and they're going to laugh at me. And yet somehow he's been fearful that people would believe his message. Now, you might say that I haven't proven that the message went through the grapevine, right? I haven't really done that, have I? But verse 6 is my evidence. In verse 6, it says, my point here is that after the word had spread, the king also mourned. Please note that verse 6 starts with the word then. The Hebrew construction says verse 6 happened after verse 5. So what happened in verse 5? The people, not the king, the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Then, verse 6, word came to the king. And he arose from his throne, laid aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth and ashes, sat in ashes. In other words, what has happened is things haven't gone through the official channels. It was supposed to be a 3-day visit. In other words, Jonah, make your announcement. Keep quiet about all these things. Don't talk to all these people about what's happening. Just allow it to go through official channels. But what happens instead? The message somehow gets to the populace before it even gets to the king. That sounds like gossip, doesn't it? Jonah didn't have to have a big speaker's voice and address thousands and thousands of people. All he had to do was announce it to an official who didn't have zipped lips. And the word got out. And the king says, well, looks like a good idea. Think we ought to have a fast. It kind of looks a little dangerous around here. People have been saying that I was going to be deposed, and we've got those neighbors up north. We've had that solar eclipse. We've had the famines. We've had the earthquake. We've had plague. Everything's going wrong. I think it might be good if we proclaim a fast. So lo and behold, he takes off his royal robes and he puts on sackcloth. He sat in ashes and he caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by decree of the king and his nobles, saying, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily to God. Yes, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his fierce anger so that we may not perish? Now notice, the evil that he's speaking about is the violence in the people's hands. Military action. Their normal foreign policy against other countries in order to raise their money. And on this particular year, the official Assyrian records say, the year of the solar eclipse, they had to put down a rebellion in one of their cities, and they had no foreign policy at all. Sounds to me like they repented of their evil way. at least for 1 year, at least against Israel. About 50 years later, different story. Now, people often think that this is talking about people believing in the Lord and going to heaven. Well, let's think about this. We know about the Great White Throne, right? Was God saying, 40 days from now, Nineveh and the whole world are going to be destroyed and the whole world is going to appear at the Great White Throne? What kind of destruction is he talking about? He's talking about destruction of the physical city, of the physical nation. He's talking about probably military conquest. Urartu might have come down and overtaken them while they were making an attack against Israel. That's speculation. But the kind of deliverance that Jonah was proclaiming, no, he wasn't proclaiming. The kind of judgment he was proclaiming was whether or not the nation would be allowed to continue. And the kind of deliverance that came about was allowing the nation to continue for another day. What I say in my notes here is the nation was to repent from their violence, particularly their campaign that was planned against Israel. In the 7 years before Jonah arrived, God had stopped Assyria's foreign aggression against other nations. They were receptive to a warning against expansionism. Israel seems to have been in their sights. In 744 BC, they resumed the old aggressive foreign policy. 22 years later, they crushed Israel, and it was time. That's when God allowed them to do so. In turn, God then disciplined them because they exceeded their authority and they became a curse on Israel. So the Babylonians conquered Nineveh, which was announced also by Daniel. They did that in 612 BC. Verse 10. Oh, actually, I would like to take note of this particular slide. We have surviving Assyrian documents. Can't really pin down the exact year that this occurred, but there was a decree of the king that was issued to a man named Manu, who became governor after 793 BC. It's quite possible that this is a reference to the decree made after the proclamation by Jonah to the lower official. Decree of the king, you and all the people, your land, your meadows, will mourn and pray for 3 days before the god Adad, wrong god, but... and repent. You will perform the purification rites so that there might be rest. It kind of looks like the king followed political correctness. I can't worship or give credit to the God that actually is in charge. Got to give credit to our false gods. Verse 10. God saw that Nineveh had turned from the violence and did not destroy Nineveh. And so, verse 10, then God saw their works. Their works. The kind of deliverance that's being given is not deliverance into everlasting life. This is a deliverance caused by them not doing the evil that had been planned against Israel. God saw their works, that they turned from their evil ways. God relented from the disaster he said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. How do we pull all this together? Remember Bucephalus, and you remember Alexander. God enabled Alexander to conquer Media Persia, a nation that had turned from, at one point, potentially being seen as blessing Israel, to cursing them. God raised up Alexander and let him crunch them. After Alexander came eventually Antiochus Epiphanes, and he cursed Israel, and God took the kingdom away from him as well. Rome rose up in the place of Greece, and at first Rome blessed Israel, and they prospered. And then there turned a point where Israel was able rightly to see Rome as their enemy, and God ultimately crushed Rome. We look at American history right now, and we're at a crossroads. Our nation has historically stood up for Israel. But right now, it's becoming politically expedient to say, not so much, right? We need to pray for our nation. God could give us this same kind of warning that he sent through Jonah. If he were to raise up a prophet, I would hope that that prophet wouldn't be running in the other direction. I hope he'd come here and tell us. And I hope our nation wakes up and recognizes that God's foreign policy is very much focused upon those who bless Israel, God will bless, but those who curse Israel, he will curse. We have a responsibility here as believers to stand up for a couple of things. We need to stand up for Israel. We need to stand up for what's right in the United States. And we also, as we saw in the Philippians passage, need to stand up courageously, even if it costs us to stand up for the message of Jesus Christ. Everlasting life is a free gift to any who simply believe him for his promise. Jonah is a fascinating book. And I think we need to take it as seriously as Nineveh needed to take it seriously in Jonah's day. Let's pray.